but we will do our best with the recommendation that, you know, you can pick up the book and elaborate the matter for yourself. This is Rule 11. Three things the worker with the law must now accomplish. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. Next, pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. Finally, to utter forth the mystic phrase which will save him from their work. And after this, this is the last of the rules for the astral plane, and then we would be ready for work in the etheric body. It's about formulas, confine the lives so they hold together. Pronounce the words which will be words of direction upon the proper path. And finally, another protective mantra. The embodied idea has now form and shape upon the astral plane, but is as yet in a state of flux. We could say in a way that the law of fixation has not yet been applied. Let's see. Is that red? Yeah, I don't want red. Okay. Orange. And the lives are only held in place through the fixed attention of the magician working through the greater builders. That's a relative term. When you run into the words like greater builders, you have to ask yourself, greater than what? Because there are some very high beings called greater builders and others who are simply relatively unconscious that they're working with elemental lives. So they are, in which case the elementals are called the lesser builders, and the devas on the evolutionary path are called the greater builders. So the law of fixation, not yet applied. And that's a fifth ray law, actually. Okay. And the magician cannot forever hold his attention on that which he creates. There has to be some way of getting it into sufficient shape to let it go and do its thing. And we used the analogy yesterday that when you raise a child, there comes a point where you say, well, look, I've done the best I can for you right now. You can come home for the holidays, but in general, you know, go out and be in the world and take everything you've learned here and do your best. So the analogy holds. He must, through knowledge of certain magical phrases, make the work more permanent, and not so fluid, and independent of him, of the creator, independent of the creator, and fix the place of the vitalizing elements within the form. Now we have to find out what are these vitalizing elements, but in other words, give it stable vitality. Give the form stable vitality. Okay. And give them an impetus which will result in more settled concretion. Fix the place of the... In other words, give them, the vitalizing elements, more settled concretion. Having accomplished that, he becomes, if it might so be expressed, an agent of karma. Okay, he has created something which will have an inevitable reaction to it, and sends forth the dual thought form. Why dual at this point? Why a dual thought form? Clearly as it says, right? It's a dual thought form because how many aspects is it carrying at the moment? Just mental matter and astral matter, right? So it's dual, right? Send forth the dual thought form clothed in mental and astral matter to fulfill its mission, whatever that may be. Okay. Finally, he has to take steps to protect himself from the attractive forces of his own nature. And we found out that unless you banish some of the Agni Suryans that you have been using, they can return and drain all the forces of your nature. So the forces of your own astral body may attract them back, and then the result will be disastrous. Another result which might happen is now discussed. He takes steps to protect himself from the attractive forces of his own nature, which might eventuate in his holding the thought form so closely within the radiance of his own influence that it would be rendered useless. So it seems to say it may not be in the aura per se, but close enough so that it never can go and do its work. It's like some of the people, I've seen them, you know, they keep on refining what they're writing. It's never good enough to let go. Never good enough for anyone to see. I've sometimes seen this accompanied with the sign Virgo prominent, because that endless perfecting goes on, and the whole birth process is to occur, but not yet, not yet. So the inherent energy of the thought form could be neutralized and its purpose would be negated. So we have to counter the tendency to hold. We must take the risk and release. You know, premature release eventuates in a product which is not useful. It is inferior in some way. It cannot do its job because it's not prepared to do its job. And belated release means that the day of opportunity has passed and the powers of the thought form may be reduced. Have you had such experiences in your life when you've had to release something to the public or to someone, and the question of the timing of the release was in your mind? You know, think about the movies and the timing of the release. When is something ready to let go? And when do you have to keep on perfecting it? I was thinking about the poet Walt Whitman. You know about this American poet, I think. And he wrote a very famous book called Leaves of Grass. It's a book of poetry, 100-something or 200 pages long. It's the only book he ever wrote in his life. And he kept on refining it. But you see, he did release it, but then he kept on refining it and release it again and so forth. It's one of the great, great books of poetry. Yeah.
And so is the art of the artist.
Yes.
To say, well, now my work is finished.
Exactly. Yes. When can I do no more? And when would anything that I do or try to do further take away from what I've already done? because it reaches a point of relative perfection where you keep on trying to improve it and it just goes down.
Yeah, I think it's so important with the Saturn, because even if you have a good work and you continue to work, maybe the moment has gone.
Yeah, I know a man who kept promising he was going to write his psychology book. He was actually a good psychologist. And he spent 30 years telling everybody about the book he was writing. I even sent my daughter to him for a year to help him do it. No progress. And the book never came out. And I'm sure it dawned upon him that the wave had passed, when his book would really have had its place and its effect. All the circumstances had changed through this process of delay. This individual had Mercury and Venus both in Virgo, so the endless thought of how to refine was always in his mind. But in fact, he never really even started it. So this business about creativity and when to release that which is created is a very intuitive matter for the artist or for whatever creator. And I know we all have experience with it. Now let's see what happens here. The holding of the thought form so close.
I can tell a story about this, because I know a man who was very important to him, to knowing about time, the right time, the right place.
Yeah.
And he is also always working through a mandala.
Okay.
Dead points.
Okay.
And he does it twice. Second time at a higher level. And always he looks back at a special point in the mandala, just before the half circle. He is looking back for collecting what's done and what is missing, and for getting in touch with this.
Yeah.
Now I have to do it. And then when the mandala has gone through two times, that's also 8, he knows.
Then he knows.
And then he released.
Then he released, yeah. A very, very strong sense of timing, and he has a formula to do that. They might also produce such a powerful, attractive force that he would draw the form so closely to himself that he would be forced to reabsorb it. So we have two mishaps, either so close that it is weakened, or later, even absorbed. This can be harmlessly accomplished by the man who knows how, but results nevertheless in a waste of energy, which is forbidden under the law of economy. That's interesting, that we are not even allowed to waste energy. If we follow this law of the third aspect. So in other words, you went to all the difficulty of creating something, then why reabsorb it? All of that energy went for nothing. With the majority of men who are often unconscious magicians, many thought forms are malicious or destructive, and they react back upon their creator in a disastrous manner. So, you know, it's the boomerang effect, and what we send out returns. The return may not be exactly what we sent. It may be in kind. The return may be the result of what we sent back. Send out. So I think the main thing is that the quality of what we create must be scrupulously intended to. Because it will have an effect upon us, and we have to learn formulas of release. Now, if, I think we discussed this, but if the word is sent forth with strong selfish intent, there's a magnetism which brings it back to its creator. But if the person who sends forth is decentralized, if the person who sends the thought form forth is decentralized and serving, then the thought form is meant for all the others and will return only in good energy as the result of the lives touched. In other words, it doesn't necessarily find its way back to the sender in its original form. But selfishness itself is centered in the energy system of the person who sent it forth, so the attraction is there to bring back the selfish and cruel thoughts. Okay, well, that's all he says in Cosmic Fire. I think that's the end of it. It's just a very short little section. And then we have another 100 pages in White Magic. Excuse me. So again, this is the rule, and the three things must accomplish: confine the lives, tell them where to take your form, and save yourself from their work. So we're going to analyze the three sentences, and there are other factors. We're not going to get into this salvation from death. I don't know if we'll make salvation from our thought forms. Let's see. This rule is, as you know, the last of those governing work on the astral plane. And the magical task of motivating those thought forms, which are to be expressed in some type of energy. Now, I think the word motivating is what's important here. When you motivate something, what do you do? What does it mean to motivate?
You give something energy.
Okay. You give it energy. And is there direction? Because energy is one thing, and energy plus direction is another, right? So it is direction as well. Let the magician set his form upon the proper path. So direction is involved. A thought form is a thought form, but it has no place to apply itself. Where will it be directed for application? Where directed for application? And will, as you said, will it have enough energy to bring it into manifestation? And that's the work of the inner builders or inner workers, to vitalize it sufficiently to manifest. We have considered the various energies with which men work and the power a man can wield through building thought forms. We have seen also how a man can manipulate the various grades of matter until the embodied idea has clothed itself with matter, mental matter and astral matter. Now, what about this manipulation? How is this manipulation accomplished? Manipulating matter to clothe thought forms. How is this manipulation accomplished? Do we have the means ourselves now to accomplish this manipulation? Or are things pretty automatic for us? Can we actually reach in to the various grades of matter, knowing their keynotes and the mantrams which move this type of matter, and move it? So maybe not yet, would you say? Can we manipulate? Or do we depend upon notes and mantrams to do it? And I would say, you know, there's a lot about the note and the mantram in order to manipulate the matter to clothe the thought form. Mostly what we do is we create something and we become motivated to see it appear, and that pretty much takes care of whatever clothing is done. The one thing we can do, we can sound the sacred word, and then the matter for the thought form will be gathered. That much we can do. But we cannot necessarily determine the exact type of matter that we're going to build the thought form into. What we can do is make sure that the thought form is as highly motivated and as spiritual as we can manage. That's the best, I think. Is it as good a form as it can be? And then the best matter available will be attracted to it. But we won't say, okay, this thought form is going to be built out of fourth subplane mental matter and first subplane astral matter. Sound the notes, sound the mantrams, and gather the Agnisvatas and Agnisuryans accordingly. That's not yet available to us. Okay. It is therefore this thought form a vital entity on the verge of materializing on the physical plane, but it is still on the astral plane, in this rule, still on the astral plane. Nothing, it should be noted, can now stop its emergence into objectivity except the expressed act of the will of the Creator or lack of will. So, in other words, the intensity of emotion or intensity of desire has passed a certain point, and it will happen. I remember a movie with Tom Cruise about thought police, and it was in the future. He has a lot of Sagittarius in his chart, and everybody was hooked up to a central system, and if you were going to commit a crime, they could tell just before you were going to commit the crime, and there would be an immediate intervention by the police to prevent you from carrying it through. And it was mostly murders and things of that nature. And I think that what this is talking about is a certain intensity of emotion is reached, which once that is passed, precipitation becomes inevitable. Once the line is passed, precipitation will happen, and the form will be a son of necessity, because that intensity of desire necessarily leads to precipitation. Now, have you ever had a very good idea and really wanted to do it, and then suddenly stopped? In other words, you didn't follow through. Suddenly you pulled away from your own desire, or a counter desire entered, and the line of manifestation was just cut. Or sometimes people will say with relief, whoa, I almost did that. No, they built it up, they wanted to do it, they prepared to do it, and then something just stopped them. Maybe it's a good thing. And then later they realize they almost did something very wrong. So one can still intervene in this process, but DK seems to be saying that if you keep your will out of it, once a certain intensity of desire is reached, it's going to happen. It's going to go forth into the ethers and the physical plane. Okay. So nothing can stop its emergence into objectivity except the expressed act of the will of its creator. For the form, being vitalized by that creator, is subject to his will until he has severed his connection with it by uttering of the mystic phrase. The mystic phrase which will save him from their work. Okay. Do you find anything interesting there? In other words, under your control and then not under your control. I was thinking about how some people press the wrong button on their email program and send what they don't intend to send. Has it ever happened to you? I think it can be very embarrassing. Or you send something to exactly the person you've been thinking of never sending it to. But up to that time, it's in your control. And when you press the button, it's out of your control.
Maybe we should have a checklist before we send off. Like a pilot.
That's like a pilot. Is this person on my enemies list? You know. There was once a legal person who had challenged us on some points in the University of the Seven Rays. And I have her email because I was talking with her at the time and kind of talking her out of bringing the full force of the law to bear, and she cooperated. But I left her my computer. And every time I send something, I go dit 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 dit. I jump over her name because I don't want to wave a red flag in front of the bull, you know. But one has to be very careful with these things. So,
Michael, could you do this from the other perspective? That sometimes you work on something and you believe you have a very long way to go, and suddenly you get this mystic phrase, a solution of a whole process.
Okay. Well, I think the mystic phrase, I understand what you mean, you know, that something comes in and it completes it. But this particular mystic phrase is exactly a formula for severing your connection. This, you know, that's what this one is. And oftentimes, I know what you're talking about, many things are incomplete and suddenly in it comes and it completes the job. So that's also true.
This mystic phrase, isn't that the same? The solar angel is before we are dying, and the personality is...
Okay, is this related to the word of death? Well, I know what you mean, death from the solar angel. For instance, its rule is the very last law of healing. Respond, O rising one, or how does it go, to the call which cometh from the ashram? Let's see. Hearken, O disciple, to the call which comes forth. It's the word of death which releases. Here, I'll read it for us. I think is interesting, and it has an application. We'll see whether it's the same thing or related, simply related. Because it's a severing. You know, the interesting thing is that when the soul sounds the word of death, it's a word of magnetism drawing the life back. But some of the elements within the personality can utter words of severance. So let's see. Hearken, O disciple. Hearken, O disciple, to the call which comes from the Son, the soul, to the Mother, and then obey. The word goes forth that form has served its purpose. The principle of mind then organizes itself and then repeats that word. The waiting form responds and drops away. The soul stands free. So the soul in incarnation is withdrawn. But like I say, to me, this is not a word of separation. This is a word of restitution, where you are claiming back. Here's another one, a little earlier, if I can find it. Okay, it cures disease. Here it is. Disease and death are the result of two active forces. One is the will of the soul, which says to its instrument, I draw the essence back, a magnetic word. And the other is the magnetic power of the planetary life, which says to the life within the atomic structure, the hour of reabsorption has arrived, return to me. Thus, under cyclic law, do all forms work. So what there is, because of this magnetic formula, there is a severance of the soul in incarnation from its form, but a reabsorption of the soul in incarnation by the soul. So it's a magnetism and a severance at the same time. But as far as the soul is concerned, it is...
We're talking about the results of the soul form came back.
We're talking about how to prevent the thought form from coming back.
Yes, but you are also talking about the positive results.
Yeah, we don't want that thought form back. So we make a formula of separation from the thought form.
But you use the word that the results of the soul form would come back in a positive way to the creator.
Yes, and that's a different thing.
Yeah.
I think that's simply karma, and but not the thought form per se, but the good effects, I suspect. Okay, we are dealing with something here called magnetism and severance, and it works out in various ways. So this is about Pluto, because Pluto is the scissors. Pluto is the shears. The sharp is sometimes called the sharp shears of sorrow. Sharp shears of sorrow. But not in this case. This is just the shears which cuts the empowered thought form and sends it on its way. The mystic phrase.
The lesser beings and the elementals has that each time we build a soul form, the divas we are working with, they are learning something. In this,
sure,
and their vibration is elevated.
Yes, and they stay with the thought form.
Yes.
Because you have pronounced the words which confine the lives within the ensphering wall. They're not getting out of there. Even for as long as that thought form lives, those little lives are going to continue to learn in that relationship.
Yes, but they can keep what they have learned
also. They will continue, yeah. They will continue, and then when the thought form runs its natural course or fails to be vitalized, they will return to the reservoir, but they will have learned something from the relationship. As a matter of fact, I want to just say this. the purpose of relationship, no, the purpose of sustained relationship is learning. And you know how karma puts you in a certain situation where things repeat and repeat and repeat. That's what I call a sustained relationship. You are in the same connection with the same elements for a time until an impression can be made upon you. And then I want to say the corollary to this. In chaos, there is no impression and no learning. Chaos is a continual mutation of relation, not allowing time for impression. So if everything's always moving and nothing is ever in the same relationship with anything else, no time for interplay, impression, exchange, no learning. So chaos keeps us in darkness, because we learn through interplay or through rhythmic interplay. So if you ever wonder why the Lords of Karma have stuck you in this situation, i.e. this relationship, it's so that there can be a lasting impression which augments the consciousness and the light. And then, you know, when the point has been reached where the goal is accomplished, then the relationship may break naturally, dissolve, fade away, or be shattered. That's like marriages, friendships, and all that. And DK described that when he was discussing just a couple of days ago how the aspirant keeps moving on, forming relationships, breaking them, forming, breaking, etc., at a more and more rapid cycle. So there comes a time when you outlive the usefulness of any configuration. Any configuration is eventually outlived. There is no more usefulness. Nothing, we can say, nothing more can be absorbed. Nothing more to be done or to be absorbed. And then the art comes in knowing when that point has been reached, instead of just hanging on to no good end. Just frustration, lack of learning, friction, and inharmony. And that's an intuitive thing, to know when the point has been reached. For instance, when shall I teach my last class here? Never! Well, I just joke a little bit, but you know. But I'm going to undertake a program of physical reconditioning, so as the next time I'm here, I'll be in the body. Okay.
You need a big microphone.
A microphone, yeah. I think I might take one along with me. Well, my voice is better today, but you always have to be prepared. I asked Johnny, I said, "Do you have a microphone, Johnny?" You know, he's got everything else. But there was no microphone. But we did have Mimi, so that was good. It will be here noted that this work is either conscious or unconscious. Okay. The work of severing, is that what he means? Is that what he means? In the unconscious building of thought forms,
or
you know, Yeah, right. In the unconscious building of thought forms, such as is the case with the average human being, many never produce the desired physical plane effect and fail in their intended purpose. As long, however, as a man is animated by selfishness and by hatred, this is a good thing, a beneficent thing. Fortunately for the human race, few people as yet work in mental matter. Think about that for a minute. He's saying it's a good thing that there are so few thinkers because they're so selfish. You know, here we are, educate, and so forth, you know, trying to get people to work in mental matter, and he's saying, well, it's really a good thing they don't, because they could successfully build selfish, hateful thought forms.
But don't you think a person like Obama does this?
What about him? Oh, sure. Well, I mean, you know, we can go. And look at world leaders and outstanding people all over the world, and they got to be that way because they can think and they can persuade and inspire. And there are a number of people like that all over the world, but what he's saying is few people. You know, and the thing is, he also tells us that few people can be reached by ideas, and many more have to be reached by ideals. What does he mean by that? Some can be reached by ideas, and most have to be reached by ideals, with an L. So, what does that mean? It's got to have a lot of emotional appeal. It's got to touch the astral body. You have to motivate people to want to do something. Getting them to want to do something is even more important than having them understand entirely why they're doing it. See, a person who's reached by ideas knows exactly all the implications and a good reason for doing this, but most people have to have a good feeling for doing it. The desire has to be awakened in them.
Well, since we often talk about people with fixed ideas.
Yes.
And then I think that they have to be mentally, but they are repeated constantly.
Yes.
So they are building like a crystallization. They are crystallized.
Yes.
Time because they are repeated so many times.
Yes.
But the creator is limited, is imprisoned in his own idea.
Yes, and he basically told us that when we have a powerful combination of the sixth ray and the fifth ray together, that's when it happens. The ide fix. But anyway, he's saying not so many people work in mental matter. Most of them work with astral or desire matter. And these forms are fluidic and changeable. You know, many changes of feelings, more changes of feelings than changes of the thoughts we hold, and are powerful only through the faculty of persistence, not in themselves. But if we keep on repeating these feelings, they have power. If we repeat feelings, they have some power because we keep repeating. But they are not firm in themselves. Okay. Now, there is an occult basis for the statement that if one desires a thing for a sufficiently long time, one will possess it. Such is the law governing the return to incarnation of the average human being. In other words, I'm here because I want to be here. And when we stop wanting life on the physical plane, after having fulfilled our karma, we will be released. But as D.K. said, or the Buddha really, it is our desire for physical incarnation which brings us back. So the Buddha taught to teach people the undesirability of endless repetitions of physical incarnation. They use their mind to teach themselves all of the disadvantages of constant return. How do you feel about your own return? Do you plan to return? Yes. The motivation of the aspirant and disciple is return not for acquisition, but for service.
And DK states that it's essentially an act of will
to
return.
Well, at that point, I think, but for most people, it's an act of desire. But I think all of us, when we're shown the movie of our life and the unbalanced karma, and we're, no, because we have a different perspective, and we, in our soul, we have love and the desire for harmony and so forth, we're very motivated to serve the lords of karma, to make things beautiful and to see the plan, which we appreciate much more fully after we're passed away from the physical brain. To see all that take place, we're highly motivated, and we come back out of love as well as will, and not so much just out of desire.
That sounds a bit like a personality thing. I would think that it was, would be the soul that urged you to go back in the next, into the next incarnation.
Well, you are the soul, and as you become sufficiently evolved, you realize you are the soul, and as a soul, you wish, desire, and love harmony, which the lords of karma are always trying to produce. So your reason for going back becomes to bring beauty and harmony and love and soul qualities to the world instead of what you can get out of it. It's so interesting, when you have the desire for acquisition, you do get, and then you go to heaven to make something out of what you get. But when you don't want what is here for its own sake, but your motive is to serve, you are no longer acquiring that which has to be taken into Devachan and much time spent to be worked up into faculty and quality. Instead, you have the opportunity for rapid successive incarnations for service purposes. So maybe some of us are reaching the point now in our lives where we don't long for the time to work on our acquisitions in the inner planes, but instead we are motivated to give rather than to acquire, and we will use whatever we have in a rapid return for humanity. But, you know, when we get on the inner planes, we'll find out. We'll be presented with that choice. And when we develop continuity of consciousness reasonably, we may not even have to dissolve our astral body. We may be able to go right back in from the astral condition, keeping our mind, keeping our connection with our soul, and take rapid re-embodiment from the astral plane. But it's worth developing the continuity of consciousness, because we're told that if we have that, such an option is possible for us. And that's really a huge time saver in a very pressed situation in the world. Otherwise, it can take quite a number of years between incarnations. We've discussed that before. Okay. Such is the law governing the return to incarnation. For the average human being, I am reborn because I want or desire to be reborn. And then there's also soul groups necessarily taking incarnation. Lacking the one-pointedness of mental plane matter, in other words, the ability of matter to hold its orientation, the ability of matter to hold the orientation in which it is fixed. Lacking the one-pointedness of physical plane matter, as it is influenced by a concentrated mind, the desire forms fail to do the damage they otherwise might. So bad desires are a lot less bad than bad thoughts, a lot less dangerous than bad thoughts. Their effect is felt largely by the creator of these camomanasic forms and not by his environing associates. So we are busy making ourselves sick by what we desire. And mostly, what we desire is not hurting others as our thoughts could. That's kind of interesting about the relative power of desire and thought.
This OECD action for people who compulsive action. You know, you have a bad basic fear, and then you make a mental thought form to release you from this fear.
Yes.
And you drop all this back in this fear, and this thought form is repeated.
Yes.
And the only one you hurt is yourself.
Yes.
Because you can see.
Yes.
The surrounding is not.
Yes.
Maybe they can feel it.
Right, they can
but
feel
something. They're not involved in it.
Right. So
the example of
Yes, exactly.
OECD is called.
OECD.
Yes.
OEC. And it stands for obsessive something? Compulsive.
Compulsive disorder.
Yeah. OCD.
Yeah.
OCD. That's right. The moment the mind factor enters in and becomes dominant, that moment a man becomes dangerous or useful, as the case may be. Dangerous not only to himself, but to those around him, or useful in working out the plans of evolution. So this is emphasized always about our responsibility in relation to our thoughts and speech, which, of course, are the main generators of karma, good and bad. He can then create thought forms capable of producing outward manifesting results and tangible effects. It's on the hard line, of course. It works its way through. You know, 1, 3, 5, 7, thought works into manifestation. I'm remembering that Asajoli said that even the tiniest little thought inevitably works its way toward manifestation, just by having been created. Given aspiration, however, and spiritual impulse, a man can become a true occultist and produce organized results and functioning organisms upon the physical plane. So, creativity. Master Moria says it's a lot about making new combinations. And if these new combinations, let's put it like this, if the new combinations reflect an archetype, then the combinations will be empowered by that archetype. And will have heavenly vitality behind them. If the combination you make is just a combination, it doesn't have any higher source of energy to plug into. Nevertheless, powerfully created thoughts could also connect with negative archetypes. In other words, the plans of negative, great negative entities, and then they could be very powerful. They wouldn't be the true archetype in the mind of God, but they would be archetypes or foundational thoughts put forth by destructive beings. Excuse me, by the time this is all over, Anna Minna won't have any green drops left. Okay, so when you think of yourself, do you think of yourself as a thinker who has been creating thoughts which do have a significant effect upon layers of your environment? Are you affecting your environment through the power and formulation of your thought?
Could be more.
Could be a bit more. Well, you know, we all do. You know, every time we get on the telephone or Skype or whatever, you know, we're exchanging thought. We are having an impact. But I'm sure that as our focus, as our service becomes more focused, that our impact can always increase for the good. We're learning how to do that. Look at someone like Master DK. He has formed thousands and thousands of words and concepts. Has his thought had an impact? Certainly on our lives, hasn't it? I mean, where might we be if we had not come under the impact of those powerfully focused thoughts? We have been tremendously changed for the better by the impact of his formulations. So as our service over our next lives increases, we will step into those kinds of shoes and be able to do likewise, step by step by step. Okay. A man is going to create an organism. This is the word he wants to emphasize. Not just an organization, but organisms. I use the word organism deliberately, for it will serve to convey the idea that any thought form is regarded by us as a subjective existing entity clothed in matter and capable of manifestation, like a thing alive. A thought form is considered a kind of life, a kind of living thing, or a life.
We are created in the picture of God. I think all sound forms
we are
created in the picture of our.
We are programs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Mr. Smith. We are programs. We are thought forms, and really, you wonder how much the great creator pre-envisioned before the universe began to unfold. Since we were there at the beginning, did we pre-vision this kind of embodiment, even at that time? How far does it go? Into how much detail does it go? I mean, we'll find out, of course. And in fact, we already know. On the higher levels, we already know. Or did the great creator only envision some general archetypes and leave it to each one of his successive emanations to go more into detail and more into detail and more into detail? You know what I mean? Like, I'm number one and I take it so far. Then number one and two come out of me and they do something. And then come three, and then come seven and 12. And each one of them imagines a head for the types of beings that will come out of them, what will be the nature, the circumstances, the structure. Is it all done, is it all prefigured at the beginning? Or is there a successive prefiguration in every emanative circle?
They have to be related to the plan of God. You can say it in this way. As they could, okay, they can build out their own, but there is But there is still this direction, this purpose built in.
They are responsible to the One, and they cannot create on their own because they are the One. In other words, they are not allowed to create against, I mean, as spirits, as monads. By the time you get down into the realm of illusion, there's all kinds of creativity that is not in line with the original intention. But any emanated spirit is still the One Spirit and will create accordingly. Even our monad, even the monad of bad people, has created accordingly. It's only in that extension of itself, the prodigal son, which becomes surrounded by illusion, that the bad kind of creativity occurs. Well, anyway, when we get ourselves out of this confinement, we'll learn more about those inner creative processes. I'll tell you what, Giz, I'll give you this to read, if you will, from the black on top. I use the word organism.
I use the word organism deliberately, for it will serve to convey the idea that any thought form is regarded by us as a subjective and existing entity, clothed in subtle matter and capable of manifestation.
And I've given a definition here for entity, because not all entities are lives, or at least authentic lives. An entity is a vitalized configuration of energies and forces, not necessarily ensouled. In other words, I can create a living, moving thing. My idea has made it, but it is not conscious within itself. So an entity need not be conscious within itself, but a true life is.
Cannot
reproduce, you say?
No,
maybe not. Or even if they could reproduce itself, it would only reproduce things that also did not have an interior consciousness or spirit. DK says that man may succeed in creating lower forms of life, but never the higher, because the higher will require ensoulment. It will have to come from a monad as a soul, and any creation of man will not have soul, unless, of course, he manages to put his own soul in that which he creates through a psychic power, which is a lot like overshadowing. But then it wouldn't be an independent entity. It would still be simply an expression of him. Anyway, we get into this magical, these questions of the creative process. So an entity, he is not, need not be, ensouled, or inspirited. Anyway, an existing entity clothed in matter and capable of manifestation. Okay, read please the black parts.
This is called popularly sometimes the working out of an idea or the carrying through of a project. It is termed at other times a discovery or an invention or something that all the time quite unrealizing it. Man is talking in occult terms and evidencing an inner appreciation of the methods whereby all that has been thought by God or man comes into existence.
Okay. An idea comes, the idea has to be worked out. Worked out as an organism, a project, whatever. Some bright idea comes, someone discovers something, an idea comes for a different way of doing things, that's an invention. The fifth ray is involved here so often. Something of that nature. This is all participating in the creative process. But the question is, is it unconscious or is it a conscious act of accessing ideas? Yes. Yes.
Isn't this the example of the 101 monkey theory?
Uh-huh. Okay.
Where you can say also people, there's just a lot of people all over the world get the same idea at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it prepares the field, and it makes the thought strong enough to precipitate simultaneously in many, many places. Well, here he's just talking about accessing ideas. What you're talking about is the speed and range of the accessed idea. You know, because in the beginning, a few people are thinking something, and eventually everybody's thinking it. How did that happen? It doesn't just happen through word of mouth. It also happens because the idea gets stronger through the repetition of the many who start accessing it.
And this process is also very well aligned with the sign Aries and its challenges.
Such as?
In general. You know, the Aries.
The birthplace of ideas.
Yes, and let the form again be sought, aligned with the plan and so forth, by applying the mind principle.
Right. I think, it's a Mercury thing and recognizing the archetype and trying to replicate the archetype and bring it out to others and so forth. But eventually, as you say, it catches fire, and before you know it, many are now susceptible and responding to it. So DK says the very things we are working on now will one day be commonly accepted. And it's not just that we will be talking about them, but by the fact that we are working on them, we are thinking the truth into expression. So our thought power is being added to the power of these ideas to precipitate. Because we're adding our energy to it, our efforts, they will be strong enough to affect many more. So I can't think exactly of how he talks about this, something like thinking the teaching into expression, something like that. We have to do that, he says. Okay, proceed, please.
The embodied idea or thought, the former being potentially far more potent than the latter, has worked its way through to the verge of physical manifestation. Its creator, who, in the case of a white magician, is not an emotionally centered person, is consciously bringing it to the stage when its inner purpose and plan can be demonstrated. He holds the thought form in his consciousness and gives it shape and energy through the power of his own one-pointed mental focus.
Yeah, so this is the word he's brooding upon the thought form. It's like, you know, the bird, the chicken, the duck, whatever, that sits on the eggs, warms them, broods upon them, on the eggs, and when the little birds hatch, they are called a brood. They are the result of that focused warmth that has made it possible for them to emerge. So here is an interesting and important idea, or thought rather. We oftentimes use the word idea and thought indiscriminately, but an idea is not a thought. So, just in general, I would like to make a distinction that ideas come from the cosmic etheric planes, and thoughts are concrete, coming or appearing, let's say, on the lower 21 or 18 subplanes. So, in other words, ideas are beings in the vital body of the solar logos. And thoughts are entities in the dense physical body of the solar logos. So when we talk to each other and you say, or I say, I have an idea. Well, maybe it's an idea. It's more likely just to be a thought. I have a thought. But if I really had an idea, it would be an incredibly inspiring thing that might grab a hold of me for my whole life. It's a being that I am serving. When I get a true idea, I am serving the idea being.
The work of Britannica called The Great Ideas was an attempt to distinguish between ideas and thoughts, I suppose. Words such as time, justice, and their like, they were taken as representatives of ideas, and maybe they are.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Because if you look at these great abstractions, time, space, justice, you know, goodness, all that, they have no concrete location. They are in the non-local world. So let's just say that the cosmic etheric planes are worlds of non-locality, and ideas too are non-local. But thoughts have much more, thoughts are more subject to time and space, and to location, and to concrete context. So it's just the contrast between what is general and what is specific, really. What is abstract and what is concrete. And let's just say that if we really get in contact with ideas, it can be an inspiring experience. How can we relate the thought of ideas to the thought of inspiration? The concept of ideas to the concept of inspiration. How are ideas and inspiration related? And think about breathing. Okay, let's relate some words. Breathing, ethers, air, life, the breath, ideas coming from the realm of air, from the realm of breath, breathing ideas in as one would breathe in a higher breath. It, they give us life. Because they come from the realm of life. In other words, most of us right now are stuck in the dense physical body of our solar logos. And even when we meditate and say, I want to center myself in my causal body, even if we succeed, we're still in the dense physical body of our solar logos. There is no true life in that dense physical body. Only once we get into the Buddhic plane and beyond do we touch the life or pranic aspect of our solar logos and become inspired, which means to breathe in, right? So inspiration is to breathe in life and become animated and souled by it.
And this is also the essence of the Socratic dialogue, to aim for, you know, the realm of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Those dialogues are extremely inspiring.
So, Socratic dialogues to live the inspired life through contact with those vitalizing agencies called ideas. Do you think Socrates was a real being? Or was he an invention of Plato? You're the man who studied it. I expect an answer.
I suppose so.
A right answer, thank you. Well, you know, we're just trying to figure out who was Pythagoras and who was Plato. They're obviously both masters now, but were they the same? Were they different? Was Socrates a real being? Did Socrates, yes?
Shakespeare.
That's another one. Or was he one being or a coterie, a group? They're working on that now.
The face of Socrates, it's like this statue. Yeah, I know in Egypt you have this, they call them best, such small figures with a great humor.
Ah.
And understanding, but they're ugly. They're
yeah.
They're falling completely out of the system. But I always thought about Socrates like one of these.
How do you spell that word?
B-E-S-S.
B-E-S-S, Bess.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, how interesting. Socrates as Bess, huh? Now, actually, Socrates has... Socrates is given a horoscope. He apparently has a time of birth, and he seems to have been a real figure. And such a being as that is certainly a master by this time. Who is he? Do you think he's Master DK? I mean, you know, some people have thought, you know, because Master DK too, he was always hiding his appearance. You know, you have these really good-looking Master Maurya, Master Kuthume, they look like gods, you know. And then there's DK. And it's like, you know, here's Plato, here's Pythagoras, and then there's Socrates, see. You know what I mean?
But there's a lot of humor.
Yeah.
So much love and humor. Revealing so much and so great understanding of the condition of the human being.
Yes, and he was willing to talk to everyone. He had a lot of third ray and a lot of second ray. And he had first ray because he was quite a soldier. Had a huge will. And Master DK says, there is something in my nature on the first ray. But it is triadal, he says. So it would be great to solve the problem of who is now the one who was Socrates. Because we pretty well know, we have a stable point that Pythagoras is now Master KH. But who is Plato now? Is Pythagoras and Plato, are they the same? In a way, they don't seem the same, because Plato seems to have more third ray than Pythagoras. Pythagoras seems to be a sage on the second ray, fourth ray, and fifth ray. But Plato, with all these dialogues and all this manipulation of ideas and all the back and forth, there's third ray there. And like D.K. said, the synthesis of ideas is Plato's great gift. And then Socrates takes it out onto the street, as it were. But I think Plato would have been then a younger man than Socrates, right? Socrates would have... Plato would have outlived Socrates by a long time. I think this could be researched. It would be very interesting. And, you know, in terms of the former lives of Master D.K., there was a great Neoplatonic sage called Plotinus. The first of the really powerful Neoplatonic philosophers. And he was interested in health and education, and he ran schools for young people, and he had the most profound kind of writing. It seems like a possible Master D.K. connection. One also wonders about the sage Lao Tzu in China. And then there are two Buddhist scholars, one is Nagarjuna, and other is Aryasanga, and they were associated. So the tradition says that Master K.H. was Nagarjuna, or Nagarjuna, and Master D.K. was Aryasanga, in the early centuries A.D. in Buddhism. As far as more recent incarnations of D.K., he said he had two European incarnations. When did Europe begin? Was Greece Europe? Could it have been considered so? But if you think about that which existed before Greece, you couldn't call it Europe, could you? I don't think so. So I think...
You could say the culture started around the Mediterranean area.
The European culture, I think, what we call the cradle of our civilization, not Egypt, that's not Europe, but Greece is Europe. After all, Greece is a member of the European Union.
The Greek has this myth about Europe and the whole...
Europa.
And it was, I say, more like a seesaw for Europe.
I think so. That what you say.
Away was from Crete, which is the island.
Crete.
Which is on the way to Egypt, between Egypt and Crete.
But when you think about Crete, you know, it has much more of a Grecian association than an Egyptian association. No matter how it may be. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway.
But it's 50-50 because you have 50. Population.
Well, just to try to keep to the idea about what does Master D.K. mean by his European incarnations, my impression is that we should go no farther back than 2,500 years ago looking for them. And maybe E-U-R-O European. And here he says, I am an Oriental. 1890. I am an Oriental of the fourth root race, and although I have had two European incarnations, I still at times fail to grasp or understand the Occidental reaction. So when we're looking for these European incarnations, My present thought is that we should go no farther back than ancient Greece. And then we would be looking for something even more recent. Where did these Neoplatonists express themselves? Plotinus, Proclus, and Iamblichus. In what part of the world? Were they still in that area, weren't they? Mediterranean, Assyrian, and so forth.
What about England in the Middle Ages, or maybe a little later, the beginning of the Renaissance? But because he came as such an old English language in the beginning of the books.
Yes, I believe that that there is something, an English incarnation there.
Yeah.
That's my impression. If we look for Plotinus, and Greek, about 204 to 270 AD, a major philosopher of the ancient world, and generally considered to be the founder of Neoplatonism. So, you know, the whole idea of Pythagoras, the Platonic academies, and Neoplatonism, this is the line on which the KH, Plato, and DK are coming to us. But I think if he's had two incarnations, and Plotinus was one of them, and he had to have learned English somewhere, because he knows it the best of the Oriental masters, then we can't have all three. We can't have Socrates, Plotinus, and an Englishman somewhere, because they would all be European. We just need two. Anyway, we need to do some research on this, and maybe read some of the Aeneids by Plotinus to see if we can recognize the note. Also, when I look at how Socrates was thinking and the way he engaged in these dialogues, if it's not just an invention of Plato, I don't know if it feels like Master DK to me. He seems so much more austere and reserved in some ways. Anyway, that's just a little digression.
Could I ask a question? Does he have to learn English in the ordinary way, in incarnation? Couldn't he just get it down from somewhere?
Yeah, download it. Well, I'll tell you what. Master K.H. went to Oxford in the 1850s to learn English. So if that's any example, and somehow D.K. already knew it, which was why I think he was assigned to Blavatsky, even at that period, in order to help her write The Secret Doctrine.
But could he have learned it in the Asian countries, in India, for instance?
Well, I'll tell you what, he is... Well, maybe it didn't exist yet in the 1600s or the 17, in the early, in other words, his English is of the Shakespearean kind. It's much earlier type of English than we find at the period when Britain conquered India. So these are little mysteries, and they would be nice to know. So we could see something about the development of some of these sages, how they actually worked.
Maybe you should look in the Roman period, because that's the new world.
That's also Europe.
So they're coming from the Greek,
yes.
Now in the European.
Yes, I'll tell you what though, it's certainly possible, but when I think of the Romans had a connection with England, that's for sure. But when I think of DK's mind in general, it seems more Greek to me than Roman. Although that's just an impression. and maybe I don't know enough about Roman philosophers.
It could be something in Sicily. I think the very Greek part of the Roman Empire.
Uh-huh, okay. Well, we will learn. But right now, I think what we do is we take a break, and then we come back and deal with Bess. Thank you.